Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Commander Spencer Worf Williams.
Okay, I'll take that because I do like Worf quite a lot.
We got an exciting show for you today, as it is the culmination of a whole month's worth of work, a whole month's worth of episodes, all leading to this, the review of Star Trek VIII First Contact. So we're excited to get into that, and Spencer is going to be taking the helm and talking more about what this film means for the entire franchise and some thoughts that he has pertaining to the future of this franchise. So I'm interested in hearing a little bit about that. Also with us is intern slash part-timer slash ensign slash coffee bringer.
Wow,
who brings
you
no coffee.
Like a big promotion. You're out of the academy now.
I've learned that ensigns die faster than cadets. So Amy is with us on the episode.
And death becomes her.
So, as I said, we have a great show in store. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give us them opening credits?
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website, filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check us out over on our website at filmlosophers.com. We got over 300 episodes, allegedly. Everything from action to sci-fi to comedy to romance to conversations about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website, filmlosophers.com. You can also catch us on any podcast streaming app out there, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire and find us wherever podcasts are streaming. Just look for The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow. Give us a subscribe. Let us know how we're doing. Give us a 5-star review. I feel like we've earned it.
We have.
Yes, we have. and let us know what you think of the show. We definitely want to hear from you. We will be giving you social links at the end of the episode. This has been, what was it? It's been 4 weeks.
Yes.
Of nonstop Star Trekkery.
Yes.
And I can say truly that at the end of all this, I am better for it, because this has been a really awesome experience, and I'm glad that we're going to be talking about this one as the like end point for this series that we're doing. So just before we begin, I just want to give Spencer huge kudos for taking on this series.
Thanks,
and I believe Amy agrees as she's yawning over there because she's so excited to do this episode.
I am excited to do this episode.
As she slurs her words.
I'm a little tired.
What's in that coffee over there?
I don't have coffee. I don't
have
anything.
That's right. Bring coffee bringer who brings no coffee.
I make coffee, sir.
We have an exciting episode. And as I've stated before, I am passing the helm over to Spencer as he takes over from here.
All right. So as we wrap up Star Trek month, before we even get into the movie we're actually talking about, we're talking about the movie we skipped, which is Star Trek Generations.
Which is number 7.
Yes, it is number 7, but at this point they decided to drop all the numbers because
it's
was following
easier.
A different
No. Crew. Paramount Plus still has the numbers on them.
Yeah, they do it for like box set and Paramount Plus, but like officially, if we're doing like IMDb,
look,
things.
I want to feel like accomplished here. Okay, let me have my numbers.
Hey, well, like, yeah, you're right. You did the work,
and we actually went against your wishes and all saw the number 7 film.
That's fine. Like, I'm kind of feeling we need to have like next year sometime another Star Trek month of all the movies that we haven't seen.
All the odd movies.
1 and 5,
and then 9 and 10. Yeah,
9, 10, and Abrams.
No,
just those. Four.
Just those. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's only 4 weeks in a month. What are you planning to do? Elongate the month?
I mean, I made time to see everything except 1 and 5 from this.
And yet she doesn't like to watch horror movies with us. Go ahead, Spencer. Keep talking.
I don't like spooky.
All right. So let's really briefly talk about, since we can all contribute to this, about things that happen in Generations. First things first, they killed off Kirk and did a really bad job with the original series.
Twice.
Yes.
Twice they killed him.
Oh my gosh.
They did. Twice.
like the first time was like this super heroic moment, like, oh, Kirk, you know, saved everybody, even though we don't know that he actually saved everybody. He just got jettisoned outside of the butthole of the Enterprise.
True.
And then we have his demise at the end of the film.
But then they brought in like the original cast for like, oh, we're showing you around the ship. And here's Cameron from Ferris Bueller that happens to be the new captain now. And he's not prepared.
He is genuinely Cameron. Like this guy had no idea what he was
Cameron
doing.
In the uniform. It was Cameron in the uniform.
That's what he grew up to be, a starship captain 200 years later.
He also became a dad in a couple of TV movies.
He also worked at the New York City Hall in, you know, Spin City.
I mean, really an accomplished career when you look at it.
Exactly. Yes. He knew he did horrible in the future, so he went back in time. Go ahead, Spencer.
Okay, and then, oh gosh, one of the big things of the movie. Commander Data and his emotion chip. My goodness, as a child, I liked Data in the TV show. Could not stand him in this movie.
It was a lot. It was a lot to handle for watching the TNG series and knowing how Data operates throughout the series. Very logically, he's like the this generation Spock essentially. But it just seemed kind of a lot to take in.
That is the politest way to say that.
As we're watching Data like process.
Laugh maniacally, go to fear, possibly have some anxiety attacks. I was waiting for him to like wet himself if that was an option from fear. But we don't get there. And then just,
well,
ooh,
I mean,
so many.
If there's one thing we learned from the movie that we're about to see, all bodily functions down
he's
there.
He's fully functioning.
So just saying.
We'll get into that later. Something that Amy noticed that I actually knew some background on was some of the odd costuming choices for this film.
So I saw that note in here. Is that pertaining to the main cast? Are we talking about the old crew? Or
I'm
is that
talking about any time someone in this movie is wearing not the TNG uniforms, but the DS9 uniforms.
In other words, the puffy jacket toppered ones.
No, the one just generation, so it's the colored ones.
Get it right.
I'm sorry, there's puffy jackets and non-puffy jackets, and there's no Cinnabons in this one.
Yeah,
nowhere.
So in this movie, the reasons they don't fit the cast as well is because they literally did steal them from the DS9 set and didn't make them custom ones. Because there's a little link in the notes. It leads to a photo of some toys that were released for promotion for this movie, but these toys are wearing very different uniforms that have never been seen before.
But they're very nice uniforms.
These
though.
Look interesting.
Yeah, so people are thinking these were the original uniforms for the movie, but for some reason at the last minute they were just scrapped. And everyone was thrown into the ill-fitting DS9 uniforms instead.
Now, one thing I just want to mention, because we kind of glossed over it, but it is still sad. The fact that they only brought back, other than Kirk, two other members of the original cast, honestly, probably for the better. I mean, if I would have saw Nichelle or anyone else in there for that brief millisecond that they're there, where it's literally the film is saying how old they are, I'm like, forget you. I just saw the other movie last week. They're not old.
Yes.
I'm just
saying.
Yeah,
this was also only 3 years after that last movie.
Yeah.
But like, I also like, the rumor is that like the original cast series was like really getting over freaking William Shatner.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because like, what was it? DeForest Kelly was like asked to be in it. He was like, nah, I'm not going to do it. And also, I think George Takei was also asked, and he was like, no.
he's like, no.
He's like, send my daughter.
Yeah, and that's also why most people believe that Chekhov is talking about medical stuff near the end of it. Because that's not his job. That's Bones' job.
And it makes sense. Like, I wholeheartedly believe that DeForest Kelly is the same person on screen as he is. I feel like at some point he was like, oh, I don't care. And then he just does whatever he wants and says whatever he wants. Like
he probably asked to drink and they told him no. He's like, can I drink during my scenes?
Like, Mr. Kelly, we have strict regulations now on set. Just have someone go bring me a bourbon or something like that. It's probably
the this is Romulan ale. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. It's like, your Romulan ale is brown.
Gosh.
And the last good thing from this movie was the explosion of the Enterprise D. While very sad, was really quite nice to how they did the whole thing.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
The whole UFO disconnecting and all that kind of stuff.
The separation explosion.
The separation explosion. It was cool, and it kind of gave like the whole idea of like UFO, you know, visuals with it. Like, oh, maybe it was just another Enterprise that came back in time, and that's what we see.
I mean, maybe. That was the one thing about the show is they never used that saucer separation sequence enough. But uh-huh.
Wait, enough? As in they've done it before?
Yeah.
You're looking at me like, I know these. I'm like, yeah. Duh, stupid. Why, don't you know this? Like, no, I've been birthed last month in this whole Star Trekery. I don't know if this thing happens.
They've done it twice before. Once in the series opener, which was awful. And then once again in one of the best episodes, the best of both worlds, where Picard becomes a Borg.
Oh, which so is leading that, into
is that
this
leads movie. Into this one?
No, this is four seasons later.
Oh wow! Okay, yeah. Okay. So I mean, yeah. I mean, man, I feel stupid now. Thanks.
No,
a lot.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, man. You're doing a great job.
You're asking all the right questions at all.
Apparently
the wrong times.
Not. He was like, "Yeah, of course they've done it before. Don't you know this?"
Because I'm sorry. It's just because that'd be ultra wild. It's like, yeah, just break apart the ship.
Yeah, hello. I don't know of these things. I'm like, oh yeah, cool. Is that like a regular feature? Is that only in like the deluxe models or something? Or
no, it's a regular feature of the Galaxy class. So I think the main reason they don't use it that much is because the saucer section does not have a warp core, so it's stuck going extremely slow.
Impulse power all the way, baby.
Yeah, that's.
I was terribly slow. Yeah. I have learned things. I know things now. But yes, and it also kind of harkens a little fun fact. Some of the military, the larger military carrier planes actually do the same thing where the cockpit does detach from the main body if ever they need to do that to save the pilots.
You mean the ejection button?
No, it separates like the cap.
Okay. Huh. Oh, all right.
It's neat. Yeah. It's not just an ejection button.
She's a military kid. I don't know if you can tell. Either way.
I want a cookie. I did a good job this week.
All right. Well, since that wraps up Generations, let's move on to our main discussion of Star Trek First Contact. Yeah, it's been a minute since I've seen this one, so I'm really excited to get into it. So, Eddie, why don't you give us that opening synopsis?
Sure thing. The Borg travel back in time, intent on preventing Earth's first contact with an alien species. Captain Picard and his crew pursue them to ensure that Zefram Cochran makes his maiden flight, reaching warp speed.
Directed by Jonathan Frakes, the film stars Patrick Stewart, Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, LeVar Burton, Michael Dorn, Gates McFadden, Marina Sirtis, Alfie Woodard, James Cromwell, and Alice Craig. James Cromwell became the first actor in Star Trek history to actually utter the phrase Star Trek. And Geordi LaForge's visor is replaced here with ocular implants. LeVar Burton lobbied for years to have his visor replaced so that people could see his eyes. He always felt limited his acting ability.
Yeah, that's honestly something that I think everybody has been wanting to see him without the visor at least once, you know.
Not being interrogated, yeah. But yes.
Yeah, without getting interrogated, right?
I mean, Geordi has had the worst time on the show. It's always something with him. He's either getting interrogated, having a really awful romance with someone who's not real, or he's being brainwashed by the Romulans.
Yeah. I mean, he's having all of his classic Velma moments. The smartest person in the room, but just can't see without them glasses.
Oh, gosh.
And we fixed it. Hey!
Yeah,
I was going to say.
Blowing up the ship almost.
Yep.
Well, you know, that did blow up and many people died. So, yeah, it seems like they got on board with getting rid of that visor thing. Okay, so I want to hear people's impressions going into this movie. What did you think going into this after seeing Generations, Eddie?
Well, coming off of Generations, I think the first thing that I was expecting was a more TNG feel to it. Yeah. Like there's just a difference in kind of the kookiness, I guess, if you want to say, of the antics that the original crew got into and how things panned out. Like the movie's created really cinematic moments, but looking at some of the series episodes, like most of the things that they get into are kind of, they are kind of Scooby-Doo-ish. Like there's a whole like lead up to it. It does have some comedic elements to it. It's more focused on a sci-fi fun show. Not that there was no, you know, moments of peril, but those were few and far between. Whereas it felt like with TNG, every single like decision was like a life or death type thing. And it just had a more serious sense. Mm-hmm. So I expected more of the feeling of like with Picard, with Patrick Stewart at the helm for this particular film, it to have more cinematic moments, you know? Mm-hmm. So not like Spock jumping into a tank and speaking to a whale kind of thing, you know, more like realistic type settings for what you expect for sci-fi adventures. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. What about you, Amy?
So expectations going into this one, I think I kind of actually have to agree with Eddie. Watching Generations, it wasn't terrible, but it did remind me of the 50th anniversary episode of Doctor Who. We kind of got a little bit of everything going in at everyone all mm-hmm. at once, and we're trying to do due diligence, and it kind of goes and it kind of doesn't. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, okay. So for this one, I can honestly say I was excited because I've been enjoying being able to move through Star Trek and recognize not only characters that I knew, but a captain that I believed in. So nice. I was very excited.
Yeah. And plus, like, one of the biggest things for me was this was probably the first Star Trek film I ever saw in theaters. Nice. Ever. I remember going to the $1.50 movies and seeing this one. And that's why, like, I remember James Cromwell. I remember Data, you know, having that half face kind of thing going on. I remember a lot of the bits and pieces. I don't remember it fully. And so watching this again recently for the episode, it was like watching it for the first time all over. It was great. So
nice. Yes. So this is probably the second time I've watched this recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because like I ended up watching it last month because the Star Trek series Lower Decks, they put out an episode that heavily referenced this one.
Really?
Yeah. It was basically, it took place in like their current time, so 2380 roughly, and they had actually visited that Zefram Cochran spot, so they actually had the statue there and like all the stuff. Yeah, so it was actually a very nice homage.
That's cool. What else were you, knowing that this is going to be your second time mm-hmm. seeing this movie, and after everything we've experienced thus far, you having a general idea, what were you kind of hoping in terms of after watching all the films that we've seen thus far and leading to this movie? Like, what were some of the things you were hoping to kind of end out this series with by watching this movie?
I think mostly new perspectives. Because, like, I think what I've gotten from, like, earlier movies is, like, I am older and wiser now. Mm. And I have, like, a different perspective on, like, the franchise now than I did when I was younger.
Yeah.
Mostly because I am shocked that I no longer think that the Final Frontier is not the worst one, which seems wild to me, but that's where I am now as a person. So coming to this movie, I was mostly just, this is one of my favorites. So
yeah.
I was kind of like, I don't think that's going to change.
Yeah.
But like, is there anything I'm gonna find? Like, you know, just like trying to pay attention to, like, you know, background stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Like mm-hmm. after you've seen your favorite movie so many times and you actually see it on a intellectual level, not so much intellectual, but like a more critical level where you're just being mindful of all the things that are in there and what you can bring to the table kind of stuff.
Yeah. Also, like you start to notice like the tiniest little mistakes that are in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, because like there's one part where Picard is talking to what is that lady's name?
Lily?
Yes, Lily. And he's like, oh yes, this ship has 24 decks. But like a few scenes earlier, like someone said, yeah, I was on deck 26.
Six, yeah. And then I was like,
So to be completely, you know, forward with a lot of this, with this particular film, I've only seen it the one time as of late. Like obviously outside of the first time seeing it, I never saw it on TV. I never saw it again ever since 1996 up until recently. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get a good chance to recognize a lot of the little things, mostly because I really love TNG. Like, I really like the cast of characters. I love every single individual that is on that team, and I love the makeup of, like, with the leadership of, you know, Michael Dorn and Patrick Stewart and, you know, Brent Spiner, you know, a lot of them, Jonathan Frakes, like, they're just great performers, mm-hmm. and they commit to the role. So I honestly was just engaged to the point to where I was just watching the story and looking at everything and watching the whole film on foil, that I forgot, crap, I'm supposed to review this. I need to be paying attention to a lot of little things. So like halfway through the movie, I was like, I should be IMDBing stuff here. I should be taking a good look at who's what in this movie. Mm-hmm. So,
which, well, like, I think that's just a mark of a great movie, though, when you get swept up along with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So outside, after watching the film, what were your guys' first impressions?
This movie still rocks. With, like, this, the caveats, which we will get to later, okay. which are still annoying and I wish weren't in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Still great.
What about you, Ames?
First impressions. Aw, this movie was fun. I like this. Also, there are things that I want to talk about, so I'm going to leave them alone. But chivalry is not dead.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Eddie. So my first impressions right after the movie finished is, first off, because Amy was texting me all over about the issues that she had in terms of certain parts of the movie. I watched this movie and I'm like, there's nothing wrong with this movie.
What?
There is nothing wrong with this movie.
Really?
This out within the understanding of the implications this series, this franchise has already done, there is nothing wrong with this movie.
That's a real interesting take.
And we'll get into that, because I feel like Amy's going to word vomit any minute now about her thoughts on her negative perspective about certain parts of the film.
But I'm on Amy's side with this one.
I don't,
like, on this one thing.
No, I don't. I don't.
See, this is the other thing. We have to bring up the fact that Spencer and I had the opportunity to watch this together, which meant that my movie viewing experience and Spencer's was much different than from when Eddie is usually around to watch movies with us.
Plus, I thought this before we watched it. So I was like,
Here's the thing, though. I'm just more mature.
I'm not letting that fly. We'll come back to this topic when we're ready to talk about it.
I wasn't ready to talk about it. That's not what I was bringing up, but okay.
All right, let's get into this. Before we even talk about the story, I want to talk about that opening shot of the new Enterprise E.
They have
some money in that budget.
Mm-hmm.
That ship looks gorgeous.
It looks a lot better than that floating bottle from Part 7. That's all I can say. In that opening shot.
That Don Ferion that was going for 8 minutes.
Exactly. Literally, the entire opening credit scene, and it's just this bottle. I'm like, oh. Yeah, that's a cool bottle. Where's it going?
What happened was, like, they probably had trash. Like an idea for, like, oh yeah, just shoot a bottle at the ship and, like, they're gonna put in a few names, but then, like, everyone's like, no, put our names up there. And
yeah,
it just became the longest sequence ever.
They're like, hey Tommy, I know you're doing the CGI on that bottle. We need this thing to go for a freaking long time. Can you just slow it down? Well, it's in space, right? Yeah. Okay, we'll just make it go slow because it's in space.
See, what would have made it seem like it was going faster is if they had overlaid a message in a bottle, because the beat of that would have, like, started to get you amped. And then you'd be like, oh, it's going through space.
You mean the Sting song?
Yes.
Message? No.
Yes.
What?
That's... No, okay. You see what I'm saying, Ensign? just saying.
I am not...
We can open the porthole and drop her now. Just let us know.
Porthole. Where in the heck is there a porthole?
Look at. Hold on. Go ahead, military child. Go ahead.
Like, a porthole.
Go ahead.
This is a spaceship, sir. It doesn't have doesn't have a porthole. Are you making fun of me?
So anyway,
I feel like you're right. Like, at the beginning of this movie, we get a great introduction of the ship.
It looks
fantastic. It has 1996 graphics, which for film. Outside of video games, because video game graphics were horrible then.
Yes,
but for movies, they were on point. Mm-hmm. They were knowing exactly what they were wanting to do, and they batted for the fences. And I kid you not, that ship looked amazing.
Yeah, like, it still holds up, and like, that's pretty good.
Yes.
So, getting into the actual movie now. It opens up with the Borg attacking the Federation yet again. And Starfleet's like, yeah, we don't trust you, Picard. Go do something else.
Because of something that is based on the TV series.
Yes.
Which was massive.
If you didn't understand or known the TV series implications, you were probably as confused as most people.
Okay, so this is something I wanted to talk about. Now, have you seen the episode it's referencing?
I've only seen parts of it.
And Amy, have you seen it?
Yes.
Okay. So I
kind of scared the crap out of me as a kid, because I was like, it was, I remember it being one of those pivotal TV moments where it was like, everything changes. There was not an option. And then when he gets captured and assimilated, you're just like, we've lost him. So yeah, I remember that. And it broke me.
Such an amazing.
It's great, but it breaks you when you're a kid and you're just like, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about this. My hero just legitimately got captured by it. Gave I can akin it to that moment, Eddie, when you read the Captain America, the recent Captain America one, where he was revealed to be a Hydra agent.
Oh, that was years ago.
Secret Empire. But that's
That's a very, very large understatement.
But think about that feeling, and then I applied it the same thing with Picard. It was like all hope was lost. I was super pissed. I didn't know if I wanted to watch this anymore. I didn't know where it was going. No offense to Riker. I didn't want to see Emily the Enterprise. Dang. So,
wow.
I mean, I was all for Worf. I'm Team Worf.
Okay, so Eddie, since you don't seem to know as much, how did you like really take in like Starfleet not wanting Picard there? Did it just seem jarring, or did you get it?
I mean, from a story standpoint, yeah, it made sense because of the fact. I mean, I'm not completely inept in not knowing the episode. I know the events of it and whatnot. So knowing the implications there and how it affects, you know, Picard in this film. Plus, I mean, the film does a really good job of opening the film with that flashback sequence, obviously doctored and heavily upgraded in terms of budget. You have the understanding that there is a prior relationship there. There's something going on. Mind you, if you're not aware of like who the Borg are, or if you're not aware that, you know, Picard, the danger of Picard becoming one of them, being assimilated, it does leave you almost in this sense of not really fully knowing how close to imminent and fatal, you know, danger Picard was in during that, you know, that episode. So the implications of getting to the point to where he's not allowed to join with everyone else to fight the fight against the Borg, it's kind of twofold, because it's like, if you're not aware, then you're like, oh, okay, well, you guys are safe out there. Just be cool with it. You're fine. Whatever. But then if you've seen the episode, you're like, oh, heck no. Picard's got to go up there and shove one ray gun right up. You know, all that kind of stuff. you're as a fan, you would expect that. As a moviegoer, unaware, you're like, why is he all salty for? Like, what's going on? So I think that does tend to change people's perspectives when they see that opening. And in terms of knowing how dangerous the Borg really are.
Yeah, that's the thing I've always wondered about this movie, since I already knew, I could never not know.
Yeah.
So I was always curious on like what people who know maybe less than me think about that scene. And like,
when it comes to Star Trek?
Yeah, like,
and that's
like,
everybody at this table, buddy.
Oh, yes. That's but like, I mean, like, you know, like if they don't have that context for like Picard, who Picard is and who the Borg are and the relationships, like, does this just seem like the movie doesn't know what it's doing and spinning its wheels like at the beginning?
It is a heavy risk. I mean, I have to say, doing what they did at the beginning of the movie and kind of giving a small taste to the immense feast that is that episode and the whole
arc for, you know, those, you know, for that, for the series. It is very much a risk that the filmmakers took, that Jonathan Frakes, director, took in giving folks just a small taste of the Borg and Picard's, you know, interaction with them in the series, in the film. And it does pay off later. It really does, because you do get those awesome moments of revelation to other characters about why he's the way he is in the film. So it does make up for it, but in the beginning, it does create a little bit of like, wait a second. Like, okay, was he? Was he not? I thought it's kind of final when he does, when people do become Borg. Wait, why is he, you know, then how is he him now? And it creates a lot of questions for the lowest denominator, if you will, of moviegoers.
Right. Okay, so Starfleet sends him off. At a certain point, they start listening in on, like, the battle, how it's going. Starfleet is losing badly, as per usual with the Borg. And so Picard's like, we're going to Earth to, like, fight the Borg.
Yeah.
They get there. They pick up Worf because he's on the Defiant, which is a DS9 thing. Yeah. It's nice that he just flew in from DS9. And Sisko was apparently too busy to make an appearance.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it was very interesting to bring in the Defiant, because that show was still going on. And if Worf had destroyed the Defiant, or if the Defiant had been destroyed, that would have been, that would have been a very interesting explanation for the following week's episode.
So apparently there was a version of the script where it was destroyed. And so, yeah, I know.
How?
It was crazy. Someone, like, I don't remember who it was, but someone's like, you cannot do this.
No.
Like, you can't get rid of DS9 ship on not their thing. Like, it was so wild for, like, it just to be there 1 week and then gone next and be like, oh, yeah. Borg blew it up. Like, when did that happen type thing?
Yeah. It's like, time travel doesn't work that way. It's not going to fix it. So this is not Back to the Future. You're not going to go back and everything's going to be returned to normal and there's no Borg queen anymore or something. So
yeah. So, like, I thought that was a wild thing that I learned about that. So they destroy the cube, but, like, it shoots out, like, the spear, which is the first time we've seen a Borg sphere before, which is nice. The sphere just goes back in time because it's like, whatever, I'm gonna win.
It's like, goodbye.
Yeah, which that, I think it played fast and loose a little bit with the physics and mechanics that are already established within Star Trek. Because I feel like when you have certain elements within the film where, oh, you need a warp drive to do this, or, you know, like, which one was it where the warp drive was damaged and they weren't sure if they were gonna...
You mean nuclear vessels?
No, that one, which was it two?
It was four.
It was four.
Nuclear vessels is four.
That's Star Trek.
Because they did have Spock. Voyage that was
home.
Whales.
Voyage Home, that's right.
That was whales.
But, like, part of the issue for the Enterprise was that they were having issues with one of their warp drives. And so when you have something like that as part of the mechanics, and then you have this, you know, turd-sized little pea coming out of the back end of a Borg ship, being able to travel in, you know, through time, it's like, hold up, you're just like a basketball falling from the sky. Like, where is that technology coming from?
So, like, this kind of falls into, like, the advancement of technology in Star Trek, where things, like, just pick up, because, like, it's been, like, at least 80 years since, like, that whole, like, we're using the Bird of Prey to slingshot around, and the Borg have been stealing everyone's equipment.
So. Which, mind you, there was a Bird of Prey in the film before this one, just saying. Yeah. So it's not too far off, just saying.
So, like, things just kind of escalate in the Star Trek universe because, like, not too long after this, they have the ability to temporarily transport people in, like, I think 200 years. So...
What?
That means they can time travel.
They can time travel
200 years later.
Like, in, like, 200 years, like, they're able to just, like, beam people out of time.
Okay.
So then they still don't kill
Hitler. And then these two guys...
the running joke of, let's...
No, because there's, like, a whole time agency. It's
again, another one. Look at that.
Yeah. And then these two guys named Bill and Ted show up, and they start plucking all their people. And
they be most excellent. They tell everyone to be most excellent.
Could you imagine Bill and Ted talking to... card.
Oh my gosh.
That would be That'd great. Be
the meme with just his head, the hand to the head.
The face palm.
Oh my gosh. Data, we'd leave him alone with Data. It would be so, so bad.
Data would be their new keyboard player.
I couldn't do that to Geordi, though. Geordi doesn't deserve that.
He goes, forget this. I'm going to read Rambo. See you guys.
Okay, so the spear goes back in time. Enterprise follows through. They destroy the spear. They're like, okay, we got rid of the Borg. Let's go see what they were like here to do and mess with, because they were shooting at things when we showed up. That's where they run into the whole military like underground complex with Zefram Cochrane, and they were trying to interrupt his first contact with the Vulcans that really set humanity on the path.
It's first contact with an alien kind. You don't learn that it's the Vulcans until the end.
And that's before, you're just like,
I said we knew that from before, though.
What?
Like in Star Trek history.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where did it say that before?
Previous series.
Oh, okay.
So that's like long established.
Gotcha. But so it's not just something that's like...
It's still kind of sweet that like when you're new and you are not well versed in the lore, you're like, oh, it was the Vulcans. Oh.
Yeah, because like the whole reveal at the end when they see it and everything, like the intention is like, and Vulcans, like it feels like it's supposed to be kind of a reveal. I guess that goes back to like playing to the lowest common denominator. Like if you don't know as much about the series,
or original series at least, and you just came in on TNG.
Well, is the exploits of this film mentioned in like in terms of the first contact and all? Is that in the original series?
That is in Enterprise, which comes after this movie. I'm trying to think specifically of them mentioning that, and I'm having a hard time remembering in the previous. It also could be like, because I live now, I'm just remembering it out of order.
True, very true.
This is very a possibility that I'm doing right now.
It happens.
So, yes. So, while they're like, you know, trying to fix stuff, we meet like Lily and Zefram Cochrane, who is just the most belligerent drunk for the entire future of Star Trek to just sprout out of.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which gives hope to a lot of drunken geniuses out there.
It does.
You can be the person who changes the future of the world, the future of mankind, and be stinking drunk at the same time.
Thank you, Tony Stark.
There you go. It's true.
Yeah, so while all that's happening up in the Enterprise, they're slowly losing control of the ship because the Borg are still in there, which I feel like their sensors really are just terrible because they have internal sensors that should detect stuff.
Yeah.
But while that's all happening, Picard...
Yeah, by the way, those scenes get very alien, like Ridley Scott alien-esque. Because, like, you have scenes when the Borg are not fully, like, when the crew is not fully aware that there's Borg on deck.
Those crew are deaf. Like, we cannot hear anything.
Like, they're not, so the one thing you realize about the Borg is that they don't bother you if you don't,
if you're not a threat.
Yeah.
And yet, these guys, this guy, like, slips into this, like, small little crawl space to check something and then gets taken out. And it's like... Well, wait, is that a xenomorph or is that a Borg? You know, because this seemed very like...
Well, part of the reason is probably they needed to bulk up their numbers. And once they got to a certain point, they were like, yeah, we're fine.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Right, Amy?
Yes. Because anybody that couldn't hear like people screaming in the duck system, come on.
Yeah, plus like she could not have gotten that far into the system.
She wasn't even... Literally, she was at the top of the stairs. Her body was still... like on them stairs. You're gonna tell me everybody that was in engineering did not see like blood suddenly?
It was just really loud, Amy. It is in engineering, so I'm just saying.
I'm sorry, that warp core didn't seem to be very loud in comparison to the other iterations of the Enterprise that we've experienced.
Yeah, even on the D, I feel like someone should have heard a scream.
Yeah,
but
I mean, we didn't get a Wilhelm scream, but come on, we're working on it.
All right, so we've, at this point, split the movie in two. We've got the Enterprise and Picard working on the Borg threat, and then we have, down on Earth, we have Riker and the rest of the crew trying to get Zefron Cochrane to
and not Geordi be drunk, and all them, yeah.
And get up off of, into space to meet the Vulcan so that they'll notice them.
Yeah.
At this point, we get Lily and Picard really acting together, and I want to know what you guys think about these two, because honestly they're my favorite, like, dynamic between like Lily and Picard, I think is really strong and works really well in this movie.
What do you think, Ames? You go first.
Yeah, so I actually, it was driving me nuts for a long time, and I didn't want to check my phone while I was in the movie, but Alfre Woodard, I've known as like Mrs. What's-its from A Wrinkle in Time. Like, I've known her for years.
I'm sorry, she's done more than
I know,
just...
but I'm saying where, like she's also Aunt Josephine in the series of Unfortunate Events. There's, I know, there's a whole bunch of movies and I'm not giving her her due. Like,
no, you're
not. 129
There's literally
acting credits.
A ton of things here. And
129
you're...
acting credits, Eduardo. Like, yes,
oh
I am
gosh.
Aware.
Like, she's in one of my favorite movies in Hearts and Souls. With Robert Downey Jr., a.k.a.
Oh, the one
Tony
where
Stark.
There's a whole bunch of ghosts.
There's only four ghosts, but yes.
There's ghosts.
You know?
He's got to help them.
Yeah. Like, and that's one of my favorite movies with her in it. But she's done so many other movies out there, like Blue Bayou. She's done Scrooge. She was in Scrooge.
I haven't seen Scrooge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I completely forgot about that. You have not seen that? Is that what you just said?
Yeah. She did.
What?
Yeah.
That movie's great.
Yeah,
because
it is.
It's ridiculous.
You haven't seen The Fifth Element.
Okay.
Wow.
So we're equally balanced
yeah.
in this.
We have to watch both.
I mean, and then can we forget as well that she is an incredible villain in the Luke Cage series?
That's right.
I mean, did we forget about that?
No.
You know, she's been in so many other things other than just your
up, but
one.
I was bringing up like one of the first things I actively remember seeing her as a kid. Okay, so calm down. But I liked her and Picard's like dynamic in this, because she was the BS meter. She was like the entire sequence, first off on the holodeck, is just hilarious. Like, she is rolling with the punches. She's like, okay, I'm on a spaceship. Okay, I got you. That's great. And you think it would take longer to convince her, and she's just like, okay, cool, let's go. And then on the holodeck, with the sequence that happens at the holodeck, it's so like she comes to an understanding that he is kind of nuts at this point. Like, he is out for blood, and he's not the cool, calm Picard that everybody's used to. And she sees through that facade. And so their acting balances so nicely against each other, where there's nothing crass about her. She still maintains that level of civility and decorum and just straight up intelligence. But she's like, look, you can sugarcoat it any which way you want, but it's still a poop pancake and I ain't eating it.
I really feel like her best moment of the film is when she is coming into Picard to talk to him about his insane orders to just stay and fight the Borg on the ship.
Yeah.
When she just like calls him Captain Ahab, I was like, this is phenomenal right here.
Yes.
Well, and you have two very different acting styles in one scene. You have someone who is classically trained, probably more Shakespearean than anything else, someone who has been born and bred on stage performances. And then you take Alfre Woodard, who is more commonly, you know, an American actress who has done a lot of roles where her passions and her, you know, emotions are typically risen to the surface of her performances. And we've seen it time in and time out with a lot of her characters, not to mention because she is an African-American woman, you do expect a sense of soulfulness or a sense of, you know, rigidity in terms of like her unflinching, you know, morals. And I feel like that's kind of the culmination of what we get with Lily, where her role in this film, for lack of a better term, as Amy put it, she was the BS meter, if you will. But she also was the like face the facts kind of person. Like, she works in logic. She works in, this is not doable. We need to do what's best for everybody. I mean, The woman herself is probably a natural born leader. And in the film, you can tell that that emanates really well in this character, but a different kind of leader, one who's spent probably more time in the film. The character who spent more time, you know, in the dirt and in the muck and amongst like the common people, as opposed to Picard, who is used to decorum and used to regulations and things of that nature as a commanding officer. The juxtaposition of those performances when they collide in that room are so incredible, because they're just obviously so different, but the same message is getting across, and the intent behind the message is translated to where Picard understands it completely, because she hits on a note that exactly meets him where he's at. And then you get that great kind of, after that whole, you know, back and forth, then you get that great moment at the end where he ends up quoting Moby Dick, sorry. And she then turns and is like, I've never read the book. And it's like, yes, I mean, she would be somebody who would know these things for the sake of knowing how to use them in either conversation, arguments, however, and didn't really need to read the book. Knew like, okay, I got what I needed and I'll move on. You have that great juxtaposition in those two performers, and it shines so well in that scene that in the end, they are both essentially just as characters, like on equal footing. Like they're both leaders. So it was a really great scene. And I feel like she played a really great role. It didn't, she didn't have a lot of time on screen in terms of,
I wish she had just a touch
more. I do too. Like I really wish, I was hoping, full disclosure, I was hoping, and like I said, I don't remember how this movie ended when I first saw it. So while watching it again, I was kind of like, oh, wait, when did this happen? Did this happen? I was kind of hoping that James Cromwell's character was like, well, to be honest, I'm not really the genius. It's Lily. She's the genius. I'm just working off of her genius, because the whole like sexism thing, are probably like, oh, they need a man to lead or something. I would have loved that, for that to have come out, so that way the right person would have been affected in history, and instead of what's his name?
Cochran.
Instead of Cochran getting all these statues and everything, the history books would have changed, and it would have Lily who was like the person who should have been noted. I feel like that was a great opportunity that Jonathan Frakes didn't really see or probably didn't want to do. But it was there. It was like,
it was right there.
They were setting up the plot. It was right there. She is showing every sign of being a true leader. You got drunken Cromwell down on the Earth's surface doing God knows what to not be there. Like, I was literally waiting for that. I wanted that so bad.
I mean, that would have been like a really interesting thing of like, you know, history's not always what you think of, which would have been kind of an interesting message for the film.
Yeah.
Well, and also considering that they didn't take a whaleologist. I can't remember what we call her.
A whale.
She's a whaleologist.
Whale biologist.
She's a whale.
She said a whaleologist. What is a whaleologist?
I don't know.
It's kind of like someone who's like on a weather forecast and it's just predicting if whales are going to fall from the sky.
Yeah.
Hey, that's an entire sequence in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So, but I was almost expecting I was hoping for that opportunity that he was going to go, you know what, why don't you come with us? Like, I wanted him to offer that, but the way that they left it was like, oh, okay, I understand. Okay. Like, I understood it, but it doesn't mean I wanted it any less.
Mind you, I could see.
Here's the thing. No, hold on, the thing, Spencer.
No, I could see that being a possibility, but I also feel like then the filmmakers would have been like, but we've done that already. Yeah, we already got, you know, Seventh Heaven's mom out here somewhere. Yeah.
Well, she's dead now.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'm just saying she's out there. You don't know if she's in some kind of cryostasis.
She took William Shatner's number and was like, bye.
Going back to, you know, Futurama, she could be frozen in cryogenics for all we know. Mm. Just saying. But go ahead. What were you saying, Spencer?
I mean, like, Picard is not going to make that call that Kirk did. Kirk... like, I could see him like, oh, yeah, sure, just come on with us. Not thinking about who this person is, what they could have possibly done in the past that you're now taking away.
Or what they could have brought with them in terms of, like, diseases or illnesses. Like, there's a... I know you hate this, but there's a whole episode of Futurama where Fry gets sick and he gets the common cold. And they've eradicated the common cold for, like, the last 300 years. So there's no, you know, antibodies for it. And so it creates a pandemic based off of the common cold. I mean, there's so many things that could happen with bringing somebody back. The logical sense of Picard being the smarter of the two. Who knows? Maybe, you know, Seventh Heaven Mom actually did that and actually brought back like something so heinous and people could like, she probably brought back like diarrhea or something and they're like, nope, we got to get rid of this woman. We got to, nope, nobody's getting choro on this ship. Nope.
So what you're suggesting is that Seventh Heaven Mom brought diarrhea to the future. They got super angry about it and sent her back.
It was galactic death. Diarrhea. That's what they got.
I mean, I could see them sending her back then for like, that.
Catherine like, Hicks, you're going back to your whales. Back in your time, get out of here.
Captain Kirk can't save you now.
Nope. Because I mean, let's be honest. Let's just be grown ups here. Captain Kirk brought Catherine Hicks to the future so that he could get with it, so he can get a little bit of Catherine Hicks' tail.
Yeah, like that wasn't.
That's not up for debate.
That wasn't even like a. Oh no, that wasn't it. No, that was 100% it. And her being like, "Okay, bye." I'm like, yes, follow your dream, girl. Go be a whale.
For every guy who's ever had that situation, that's like taking a girl that is that likes you to a concert that you had tickets to. And then when you get to the concert, she actually ends up leaving and goes with her friends that are at the concert as well.
Or she just needed happened to find her friends. Yeah. She happened to find her friends and it was fine.
So Kirk got, you know, left on red, essentially. So just saying.
He got left on red in person.
Yeah, on person. She's like, oh, that's nice. And then walks away.
K-bye. It's a lot of K-bye. So. But in juxtaposition to Lily and Picard, I appreciated that, like, when he leans in and he gives her a kiss on the cheek. And he's just genuine. He's like, I'm going to miss you. And he gives her a kiss on the cheek. And you see she almost wants more. Like, she leans into it. Like,
is it? Hold on.
It was just a little bit. And I couldn't tell if it was that. The genuine affection, or like, I wish you would take me with you. Like, and I don't think it was like her trying to get fresh.
So hold on. Here's a question then for Spencer, for you. Is there any mention of her in the Star Trek history, whatever?
Like, not to my knowledge.
So that sucks. Cause it's like she did. I mean, to be quite frank, she spent
6 months grounding around for titanium.
She's got more like heart and character and more willingness to lead these people than James Cromwell did. He was a literal drunk who was essentially not even going to finish the dang thing for some reason. And well, no, not for no reason, because the things that were falling onto Earth and crashing and causing explosions or whatever because of all that. But it's like, I don't know. It's just frustrating. That could have been an opportunity, going back to what we were saying the last time, for a series that emphasizes its usage of diversity and opportunities to promote inclusivity and, you know, non-sexist, you know, messages. This sure was an opportunity to really kind of hit that bell hard.
True. That's very true.
Yeah. Dang it, Lily.
Okay, so
she should have pulled. Sorry, she should have pulled a Catherine Hicks and was like, "All right, we're going," and then spider jump monkey. On him. Ha!
Spider monkey,
gotcha.
I mean, it's not like it's a time teleport. Like, it's just that you're just going to be like, "Okay, you're going back down now." No,
I mean, literally, if she had been like just standing next to them and did one of those spider monkey moves, like. Then once she dropped onto the transporter room floor, they were like, "No, we're sending you back." She's like, "You gotta catch me first." And like, phew.
She's like, I was climbing through the ducts. Yeah, I know where to hide.
She's like, "You can't find me right now." Okay, bye. It's a lot of okay, bye for me. I'm sorry. Guys.
It really is.
Okay, so let's talk about the other power couple on this ship. Let's talk about Data and the Borg.
That was a perfect segue. I'm not going to lie. Really quick, since you mentioned that, the couple part, before we get into this next part, is it implied that James Cromwell's character and Lily are a couple? Is there some kind of implication? Or is it just like they're working friends or whatever?
It seemed like they were working friends kind of thing. Like,
well,
like
that handhold at the tail end.
It was like a squeeze. Like, it was a supportive squeeze.
Oh, no, I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, there was just no fingers lacing. To the same mindset of the kiss that Picard gives with Lily. Like, I'm just, maybe I'm reading too much into that. Just like there might be too much reading into that kiss. But I don't know.
I could see reading too much into it because, like, looking at their experiences separately of that day, like, James Cromwell just went into space, broke, like, the warp barrier, and then met some aliens, which is a crazy day in and of itself. And for Lily, she survived the Borg.
Yeah. Like, this woman literally changed one of the greatest minds in Star Trek history to go from being a maniacal pursuer of this entity that just won't die to becoming a actual leader for these people. And he just got sober and sat in the ship, like, to be quote completely frank. And then he couldn't do the Vulcan, you know, greeting.
I can't do it either.
How can you not do it? It's just,
I can't, like, you have to, like, I can't get this finger to close and then this finger to stay apart.
You did good. You just did it.
No, it's different. Like, that's it. It hurts so much.
I read that the whole effort of James Cromwell's character, Cochran, not being able to and doing the handshake was kind of indicative of the long-running joke for not many people can do the Vulcan salute.
William Shatner can't do it. Also, surprisingly, Zachary Quinto can't do it.
They actually had to glue his fingers
yeah,
for him to do it in the film. I read that. Yeah. So that's kind of sad. When he does it to Spock, when he sees Spock and he does salute. Like, it's like, that should be like a prerequisite. Like, to be quite frank, like, if you're going to go do a casting call for Star Trek, like, the first question should be, can you do the Vulcan salute?
Well, if you've got glue, why does that need to be a question?
Because, like, it looks weird. Like, I don't know. It just seems kind of, I don't know. I don't know why a people's salute should be the butt of a joke for going back to what I was saying, for a series that promotes inclusivity and diversity. Like, that's the same as, like, all those people back in the day who used to make fun of, like, Native Americans with their, like, how, like, kind of thing like that. It just seems like, oh, just no. No, thank you.
Like the power couple that is Data and so, the Borg Queen.
Yes. That was, so go ahead. You guys give your arguments and then I'll give mine.
First off, let's just talk about where Data is in case people have not seen either of these movies. He is not the cold, logical android anymore. From last movie's maniacal, insane laughter to this movie, he is toned down quite a bit on that emotion chip.
But he can turn it on and turn it off suddenly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's for because probably people got tired of maniacal laughter. Like, I understand that. Because truth, if I was on a ship with that, I would go to Picard. I'd be like, we're not doing this.
We were actually coming into the studio and Amy was seen. The life form song again.
I love little life forms to search for little life forms. I love. It was so ridiculous that I think of the ridiculous songs from the first 10 or whatever for Star Trek. This tops the drunken row.
I think they're on equal footing. I really do.
This does make me remember that since we're not talking about it in the next movie, Star Trek 9. They sing parts of the HMS Pinafore in that movie.
Really? Yeah.
See, you bring up things like that, and we have a musical buff here at the table with Amy. Now we're probably going to have to do an extra credit episode on that.
I'm just going to binge it quietly and not tell anybody.
Oh, no. You have to watch it with, like, us.
Yes. Nope. True.
I don't know. I mean,
no takes it back. Go ahead, Spencer. Keep going.
Singing Data. So singing cheerful cha-cha-cha Data.
It's singing in the next movie. It's singing Data, Picard, and Worf.
Worf. Commander Worf.
He was not happy about that.
I'm not going to lie. That's enticing. Okay. So
talking about awkward moments, let's talk about Data.
Okay. So this movie introduces the Borg Queen.
Officially.
Yes, she has not been a thing in Star Trek yet. So this is her introduction. And her method of operating is apparently seduction.
Which is really awkward.
Yes.
When you come to the perspective of this is someone who, I mean, which it does get explained later on, but in the moment, yes, it is a little awkward. As she's trying to help Data by grafting actual, like, sensible, like, tactile skin onto him. Which is really unique. I mean, because you have Data experiencing things like, you know, touch and goosebumps and all that kind of stuff. So
like that was a little, so that was awkward. The initial, because it cuts in two places. So Data's captured. He's sitting there. He's like, I'm not going to talk. And you're like, yeah, Data, we know you ain't going to talk. You're good. And then she grabs on the first little tiny bit of the skin and you're like, what the heck? And then she blows on it. And you're like,
And then it's his reaction from that.
Yeah.
Too.
It's like the shutter. Oh. And she turns back on his chip, too. That was the other thing. It's because he had turned it off at one point, and now he's turned it on and he's feeling sensations and he's confused, but also excited. And then they cut. And you're like, what?
What did you say? She also said, was that as good for you as it was for me? I was like, no. This is where I...
She doesn't say as it was for me. She says, was it good for you?
But that's basically the same thing.
I'm just... So let's
One was just awkward. And then we get to the bigger heart of the matter at this point. They've grafted a forearm, essentially, of skin onto Data. He breaks out. He's like, aha, I'm going to escape. And then he gets cut and he's like freaking out because he can actually feel it. And you're like, oh no, this is problematic, my dude. And then somehow that turns into like her don't be seduced by the flesh. Like the entire thing. And then walks up.
No, it turns. No. Hold on. Pause. No. I will turn you down. No.
Turn me down.
Because you're doing it out of context.
No, I'm not doing
because
it out of context.
She tells him, she goes, if you don't want this and you don't want the temptations of having flesh, then rip it out. She tells him that. And he has this whole crisis of conscience where he wants to have it because he wants to feel because he's an android. But he also doesn't want to give in to what is going on with the Borg. He doesn't want to give in to what she is doing to him and actually acknowledging that this is something he's always wanted.
Again, I feel like he's smart enough to handle this, though, because if the Borg did it once, that means he can just do it again later. Like, it might take him a while.
Speaking of doing it again later, the walk up, the slow walk up on her that she has for Data, that he's starting to get uncomfortable and nervous, and then she asks him about pleasure, and he says sexuality. And that he's fully functioning and very well versed. And I'm just like, okay, little TMI. And then it's like, when was the last time? And he gives a precise running date for the last time this has happened. Mind you, because I was Spencer, I was screeching because I was like, what? And Spencer can attest to this. I was yelling, yeah. What?
It's
so loud you had to stop the movie because I needed clarification on what the heck was going on. And I didn't care. I was like, and I said it. I'm like, I didn't think Data was a Ken doll, but I was like, hold up, this means this android has gotten freaky deaky on the Enterprise and or with somebody, and you explain what happened. And Spencer, you need to explain it again, because
so
I was dying.
It was insane to me that they kept a running count, because like this happened in an episode of TNG where he had sex with someone, and it's like one of the worst episodes of that season. So it's crazy to me that they even referenced it, because we all want to forget.
Apparently, Jonathan Frakes didn't want to forget about it. That's all I'm saying. He's like, come on, honey, let's watch the episode where Data gets freaky with a.
Yeah, so it's in the first season episode, The Naked Time, I believe, which is an unfortunate title.
The Naked Now.
One of them is now the TNG one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Because The Naked Time is the one from TOS, and they're very similar, and it's really easy to remember, forget now versus time.
Easy to remember to forget. Got
yeah. So in that one, basically, there's a disease going through the ship. It lowers everyone's inhibitions, including Data's. Somehow, I don't get that part, but like,
because he doesn't even have the emotions chip at this point.
He does not. So anyway, like basically, the security chief at the time, Tasha Yar, basically seduces Data, and like they just have like a whole thing.
And then she dies.
Later, but yes.
But still, I was like, that has to be the running tell. Everybody that sleeps with Data is dead. So I was really optimistic about the Borg Queen.
But like, not normally that fast, to be fair.
Wow, right? The man's a walking chlamydia or something.
That's just...
You said it.
No.
Like, he has sex with people and they die.
That they do. So either way, it was just very uncomfortable. And in the scale of implied sexual encounters in the running list of movies, this is more uncomfortable than Ponfar. Ponfar, no. I understood.
No.
So this was like...
This is where my argument comes in, because...
Okay, you're arguing for Ponfar.
No, because the idea that Ponfar is a consistent occurrence that happens every 7 years,
where essentially
a Vulcan either has to have sex or they die, it seems a little kind of, you know, controversial. Like, if you think about it, because this is from, I'm assuming, Spencer, this Ponfar mentality, this idea of it, has been in the series for some time.
I don't know if it was...
I mean, it has to be, because that couldn't have been the first, you know, recognition of Ponfar.
I'm uncertain, because I haven't seen as many TOS episodes. I do know it comes up, like, after that point, yes, but, like, before, I do not know, actually.
Uh-huh. And so, with that, and the necessity of a, you know, logical thinking individual needing to have sex every 7 years, whether if it's with somebody who steps in as a surrogate or whatever, whatnot, somebody is doing the deed every 7 years. You have somebody who is logical thinking, who is being seduced by somebody who is speaking his language. It didn't, like, and it cuts away before it looks like even anything is happening. So when you were going off about, oh, you have to see this scene, it's just so crazy, like, oh my gosh,
make sure there's
no kids around because they can't be seeing that.
I said highly suggestive, and while it is not, I'm trying not to yuck Data's yum, but it was very difficult for me to not go into that, like, go, she's just using you for your body, Data. Like, we have been working so hard against
this. But that is
so
the whole point.
Years.
Like, it is very much intended through the course of that scene that she is just using him by acting upon the inhibitions that he wants to experience with the new sense of feeling that he has. So it makes sense in terms of the film.
How long was she planning this? Like, this poor bot.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. But all I'm saying is that there's a bigger move at play, and it's very much aware to the audience that this is what she's doing with Data.
But now it's also just... now.
Whereas
in,
opposed
in canon,
to we have a teenage Spock in a cave having, you know, whatevers with... having Ponfar with, what's her name? Selek. Savik. You know, Selek, Savik, it's all the same thing. with S Vulcan, there you go. In a cave... You know, and not even knowing his actual age at the time, I'm just saying.
Also, they mentioned it in season 2 of the original series. I looked it up.
Uh-huh.
Hey,
I said I was not sure.
Uh-huh. All I'm saying is, you guys are going on about how this was an uncomfortable thing or whatever. It was supposed to be.
But this also means, like,
that doesn't mean I have to like it.
And also the implications that now, not only is Data initially experienced, he is doubly experienced. And
are you really yucking on this guy for having two sexual experiences and over the course of like 7+ years?
I don't know how many more he had. And that's questions I don't need to be thinking.
It obviously had been seven.
That's Brent Spiner, sir. I don't need to think about that.
It obviously was 7 years prior.
Disguise.
It was actually 7 years prior, so it had been at least 7 years.
I don't like you mentioning that.
He's the master of disguise, and he's the bad guy.
Yeah, we don't talk. He's not even the master. Either way,
he's in master of disguise.
Yeah, he's not the bad guy.
He is not Dana Carvey. Who's the master of disguise?
Not technically.
Well, he's going to be a master of disguise.
No. I'm sorry. We're ending this right here.
Spencer's like, cue the music. I just getting back to the conversation at hand, I don't feel like it's as bad as other scenes could have created the element of, because let's take, for instance, the first question you had asked about the expectations for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Picard TNG type film. I expect more adultish type situations, more serious type situations, more grown type of situations.
So you expected drunk Counselor Troy.
Drunk Counselor Troy?
Yeah. when she was there with
Like
Cochran, and she's like, he wouldn't even talk to me unless I had a drink.
Like, I mean, that's situations that I mean.
And she marries Riker, so that makes it even funnier. Which
actually then it does make sense now that I think about it in terms of that question about the couple between Cochran and Lily. If because he asks like, oh, is this your husband? He goes, oh, great. It's not. And blah, blah, blah. So that makes a little bit more sense on that level.
Unless which is he's funny just because he has, yeah, which is funny because guess what? Turns into her husband. Hey, sorry.
Are you done?
No.
Okay. Anyway, I feel like with that expectation for this type of movie, I expected elements of this movie to have things like this in it. Maybe not to certain extents, but it is a film. And when it comes to utilizing whatever tools for a maniacal villain that we expect, with Khan, we saw him put worms in people's ears, you know? And we've seen so many different things, so many different elements of villains and how they've been portrayed. And as we move closer to what people are expecting with the modern audience at the time, things like this, it made sense for her to use things like that, especially for somebody who craves the opportunity of new experiences with touch and tactile feeling.
See, and then my question is that too much of a pigeonhole that the Borg hive mind queen is the only thing that she's going to do is seduce somebody where she has access to all these other things? I understand in using sensation. I understand the fact that Data is lacking in the area of sensation and wants to, much like Robin Williams in, was it AI? No,
yeah, Bicentennial Man. Bicentennial Man.
How he wanted to proceed to those extremes, and he took steps to do it. It was very abrupt, and then also I think it kind of did her somewhat of a disservice, where it's like, oh, I'm here to seduce you.
No, like what it does is it lets you know how low of a bar she's willing to go to get what she wants and what she needs, which you come to find out she's not looking for just another member of the Borg. She's looking for an equal. She's looking for someone to essentially.
She's looking for a partner.
Yes, which makes sense in this aspect because she didn't really want Data, but she needed him for all the things that he could do. So much like whenever there's something that we really want, we usually do the best we can to cough up the money for it, or we try to find ways to get it. Some people steal, things like that. People, the depravity of what the mind can do causes people to go to low places to do the things that they feel are necessary. And in this case, this just made us as the audience more aware of what this villain is willing to do to get what she wants, even if it means preying on the inhibitions and the desires of someone who has never had these feelings before or these sensations to experience them in this aspect.
See, so, and that's like a hard no that you're not supposed to do that to people when they're first having
a villain.
Okay, yes, she's a villain. So
villain.
No, but this just makes me angry in different villain. Places. Yo. So okay, that's great. She's the one chick leading all of these turn. Spencer, help.
Okay,
pick something else. Go.
Well, just to like give you
your
a little
argument
more,
just crumbles as I talk.
Future context on the Borg Queen herself. Yeah, Eddie is correct. That is like what she does. There was like this whole other situation with the Borg Queen later on, where she got stuck in someone's head. Long story. But like while she was stuck there, she just was like watching this person live their life, and she's like, you know, if you just did this, this would work better for you. And eventually the person was like, oh yeah, this does work better. And like as time went on, it turns out that like by doing what the Borg Queen wanted, like it did make things better for them, but like it also gave the Borg Queen access to like their actual brain, and she took over. So, like, she does do, like, manipulation incredibly well. And that's what this is. That still does not mean that I was okay with it. Get it,
and mind
but
you,
I don't like it.
And mind you, this is the step in cinematic value, I guess you want to say, in terms of taking these films and creating the separation from the series to the movie in making instances. Now, when you have on-screen villains, the villain is essentially just a person or a thing at the beginning. It is through the course of this villain's actions that you understand the depravity and the depths to which they will go to get what they want. Take, for instance, one of your, Amy, one of your favorite movies, Meet the Robinsons.
Aww.
So we have, what's his name?
Bowler Hat Guy.
Yeah, you have Bowler Hat Guy, who is essentially Goob.
Yes.
He's Michael Goobian. Michael Goobian.
Mike, yeah, Goobian.
And
he's seduced by a hat.
And he's essentially...
It's a bowler hat. It's a sentient bowler... Wait, Spencer, have you seen this?
No.
It's a sentient bowler hat. I need you to see this.
But it essentially... He essentially gets to the depravity of needing to go back in time so that way his life can be better, even if it means making Will's life... Will? No, not Will.
No, Wilbur is the son. The main character that we're following, yeah. I know.
Yeah.
Cornelius. He becomes Cornelius.
Yes. Making his life a living hell. And you see, even as in an animated film, the depths he's willing to go, he goes back in time to get a dinosaur. Like, he's willing to go to those depths of depravity.
Spencer needs to see this movie. So, I would approve of this.
So we understand that in an animated film, you can convey the depths of depravity or the depths that to which a villain will go in instances like that.
But see, also, that's another... That brings up an entirely another ball of wax, because in that movie, he feels that he's being so slighted and has been seduced by an outside force to come to those places. And then he tries to rectify and correct the problem.
But like I said, that's a cartoon.
But she doesn't.
That is an animated film.
This makes me mad because I don't want people to think that, hey, just because you're a woman in charge of a whole bunch of dudes, that
hello?
You have to seduce
that
them
goes,
all.
That goes back to this movie. This franchise is supposed to support and you know, show diversity and inclusivity and non-sexism, you know, messages and so forth. I'm just saying, this is what's been played before us. This is how I see it. As a seasoned film critic, This is how I view the makings of villains. Because you don't have a great hero unless you have a great foil for that. And with that, you are able to see what the hero is able to rise to in terms of the expectations by the villain's depravity and how low they will go. You know, as long as you don't, so you have this threshold bar that as long as the hero doesn't go below a certain point, they will never be just like the villain. And then you have this villain who, in certain arcs where they are, you know, possibly savable, how if they can just make it to this bar, then there's some hope for them. We've seen it in Star Wars. We've seen it in Meet the Robinsons. We've seen it throughout a lot of history's villains. And this is just one of those instances where recognizing that the Borg has no problem taking over the lives of people at just the mere touch, and they take over them and they essentially ruin them by making them part of the Borg. Knowing that that's something that this person does on a one-on-one scale, what does that look like? This is what it looks like. This woman has no depths to her depravity. She is willing to manipulate and coerce anything and anyone to her will to get what she wants. Which makes Picard much more of the action hero. Or, if you want to look at it, Data. Data being the hero that saves the day because he doesn't succumb to what ultimately she wants. You know, and that makes Data more of the hero that he didn't get below that threshold than where she would want him to be. So, it's all in the way you have to view your the depths of your villain is going to create how high your hero rises. And I think if we didn't have scenes like that, not saying just that alone, but like things like that in the movie, it wouldn't have made for a more dangerous villain. And Data doing what he does at the end of the film, it's like, oh, okay, they weren't really, you know, it's cool, whatever. But because of everything that she does to manipulate him and to make him think that he could be better as part of the Borg, everything that she throws at him, and he still shows that he is an unwavering, loyal member of the crew of the Enterprise, it makes him that much more of the hero for the film. So,
I think that's a really good wrap-up on that segment. Okay, yeah, so after that, you know, film pretty much wraps up. They save the day, the Vulcans arrive, they go back to the future. Are there any other story points you guys want to talk about before we get into our roundtable question?
One of the things that drove me nuts, and I think it might have been because I'd seen it in, like, drove me nuts, but I found myself yelling at the screen while it was happening was the aggressive hero worship that drove Cochrane to like try to run away when everybody's like, sir, it's such an honor. It's so amazing. And I'm just, oh my gosh. And I was like, you're going to scare him off. You're going to scare him off.
All of that.
You're going to scare him off.
I was like, it just has to freaking build to it being someone else. Like,
you were hoping it, right?
Like, Lily has to be the savior we're looking for. Like, she has to get down there because it's not really him who goes up in the ship, but it's her. It's just, you know, like they say, men write the history books. Like, that's kind of how it would have gone. Like, I feel like that should have been the way it would have went, and Picard would have been like, I'm going to tell everyone and blah, 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 like make sure like she, like her part in history is told. Like I was really kind of like seeing something different happen in this movie.
Yeah, you were hoping. And that entire like, and Geordi's just like, I didn't want to tell you this, but I went to Zefram Cochrane High School. And this is, you know, the first chapter. And he's
very
Geordi.
LeVar Burton.
He's so LeVar Burton. And I love listening to him. And he was so excited. And I was just like, can you stop the rest of your engineering party from scaring this man? We just need him to not drink a little bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
oh, and the doobie-doobie dance. I hated it. At the end of the film.
I feel like, it sticks with me because it's like, that whole element of that arc of the film, I just feel like there was such a missed opportunity. I really feel like that should have been the way it should have gone. Everything that they were doing for Alfred Woodard's character was like, oh my God, this is the actual person who saved, you know, humanity. This is the person, like every instance we got to see her show up as a leader, show up as like someone who thinks like, okay, I have to protect my best interests, holding a phaser on Picard because she just wasn't sure, no matter how unassuming he looked, like, and going along with everything, being in those like hollow scenes and whatnot, and being a part of it, and every situation we saw her in, culminating into that one scene we talked about earlier about them talking in the was that conference room or whatever room.
Broke your little ship.
Yeah, and like that whole scene was just perfect, and I'm like, yes, they're gonna do it. They're gonna, like, I was waiting for James Cromwell's character to be like, it isn't me, it's Lily. Lily's the mastermind beyond. She's genius. She does this, that, blah, blah, blah. She made blah.
And she's the reason this is getting off the ground.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out this formula or something. Like, even if he was the Sheldon and he needed, I had to go
and
to.
She was a Leonard or what?
No, well. Tactician would have been Howard, but like, oh, you need if Cochrane was the paper man and he needed somebody to actually build it, it would make sense that it was Lily.
Yeah,
but still, it's like you can't have one without the other, because let's be honest, when she said I was scrounging around for 6 months to find enough titanium to build a 4 meter across capsule, I'm like, she's on this hustle.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the heck he's doing, because drinking, he's obviously. To drink and dance around ridiculously to a jukebox that Lord knows has non-copyrighted material on it. But like, I was in that boat too.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to be like the big turn.
Yeah.
And I was hoping for,
like,
it, to be
everything
honest.
With the Borg was great. Everything with the storyline for Data was great. Everything for Picard was great. That storyline for that resolution could have been better. Like, I really saw, like, as a viewer, as a movie viewer, as somebody who's just watching it, I was expecting that turn. I was hoping for that turn. It would have made so much of a celebration for myself watching that turn, and it'd be like, oh, surprise, you know, knowing that I've been seeing the breadcrumbs the whole way, and then it'd just be like, oh, it is James Cromwell in the cockpit. It is him that's going to go and shake their hand. Like, oh, okay, cool. All right, yeah, you know, hey, that's all cool. And I was really hoping they weren't going to do that whole, like, oh, why don't you just come back with us? Like, no. Mm. That just wasn't going to float for me.
Oh, yeah, plus, like, with that being so close to, like, the beginning of, like, you know, the birth of the Federation, you could mess something up.
Yeah.
But plus, I feel like Picard, spending so much time with her, would like inform him of, oh, she's too important and she's what's holding things together. She has to stay here.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. And that's another thing to say about Alfred Woodard's character and the scenes that we did have, because we did mention she did not have enough scenes.
Nope.
Right. Plain and simple. Mm-hmm. However, the power of her performances and the ability of translating what she wanted through her character, it being so visible, could you imagine if there was more scenes of her in the film? Like, there would have been an uproar of multiple peoples of like, oh my God, you have drunken Louis over here and you have, you know, Commander Lily over here. Like, obviously she's the one who should be, who's actually behind this whole thing. And wait, it's the white guy, the old white guy who's, you know, in the cockpit. He's the one who gets all the glad handing and the statues and all that. Like, I felt like that would have pissed a lot of people off, just plain and simple. But like, in terms of thoughts and any last minute highlights, I just feel like that last part of the film needed to change.
So. Yeah, that would have been way more interesting, like the way you put it out there. But
I have one small highlight before I go. I want to bring up, so Lieutenant Commander Worf is hands down my, just like, I adore him. He's fantastic.
Assimilate this.
Like, that's literally it. We're in the zero gravity. They've figured out a way to turn it around so my ridiculous, like, motion sickness head could actually wrap around it. But after there's a Borg and you're like, no, Worf, and he's got a hole in his suit, you think he's gonna die, the guy shows up with a Borg hand on a string used as a tourniquet around his leg, and he's shooting. I was just like, I want to get you a lanyard of Borg arms and just let you go to town, man. You are brilliant.
These are the Klingons I'm expecting, not the ones that are like from last week that were just spouting off Shakespeare every 5 seconds.
Yeah.
The only thing I'll highlight in like just a fun fact territory is that this movie had two Voyager actors in it. You had Robert Picardo reprising his role as the EMH.
Yep.
And you also had Ethan Phillips, who was Neelix, who was at the beginning of the holodeck scene when the two Borg walked in, who stopped his Borg there. So that was neat.
Also, I don't know if you know this, but in the scenes where they showed the Defiant in flight during the battle,
Adam Scott's
in it, so yeah, that was
Spencer,
actually cool.
Spencer brought it on. He goes, this is Adam Scott's first one. I was like, really? And then someone was like, oh dang, okay.
So here's my roundtable question. Which of the two TNG movies that you've seen would you recommend? And this can also be read as, which movie has the better data?
So I feel like this is a difficult one for me, because I like the story for... So I liked this story. I really did. But the whole Cromwell and, you know, Woodard kind of situation and how they kind of ended out with characters, I feel like one of them got kind of hosed. So I like the other one, the other story better, but I like this data better. It's weird. I would rather have an opportunity to show people, hey, these guys were once important. We're not going to focus on them long. And one of them dies. Wink, wink. But we get to see Picard and all this happening and blah, blah, blah. You know, and we get, what's his name? Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Sorn.
Yeah. As the villain. Like, how awesome is that? And it's great. And we get to see a reprisal of Captain Kirk emerge back and save the day and die. With his last words, oh my. Like, you know, I like that story better, but I liked this data better. So, what about you, Ames?
Surprisingly, it's kind of in the same boat. I liked the story of everything that Generations did, even though they totally just, they snowballed the original cast. It was just no. Mm-hmm. It was a hard no. Being able to see the TNG cast, how they're working, how they're moving, and then the sequence inside the Nexus was such a great, like, it reminded me of the Superman book, the Christmas, it's the Christmas story for the man who has everything, where Superman essentially gets this thing stuck to his chest and he's put into a trance-like state where he is on Krypton. Krypton never exploded. He has a wife, he has a son, he has his entire thing, and he actively has to make the decision to leave. And he ends up telling his son, you're not real and you don't exist. And it's like this entire thing that ends up shaping part of the Superman mythos. But you see Picard doing that same thing where he wants so desperately to kind of give himself that space to celebrate. He has a family, he has children, and his nephew, who has been the driving force for his emotional turmoil this entire movie, is there. And it's so well acted and it's so lovingly done. And the date in there is freaking nuts. Not even nuts. It's like, oh, you nuts. So Freak-a-leak Data versus out of control Joker laugh Data, which Brent's got a crazy laugh when he like forces it. It's really alarming. Yeah, I would take Generation's story, fix a couple of things, and then I would take
Freak-a-leak Data.
Freak-a-leak Data. And yeah, because it can turn off the emotion chip, so it's really hard.
What about you, Spence?
I'm going to end on both the Data and the story from First Contact.
Really?
Because I can't deal with that maniacal laughter. It's too much. But for me, the story of Generations, well, it's great. It does bother me how they dealt with like the TOS cast because, I mean, it just seemed kind of like an afterthought, really. Mm-hmm. And then like the whole death of Kirk thing was very controversial.
Yeah,
especially how it was handled. And yeah, I don't know about all of that. So like it kind of just leaves it in a kind of weird spot for me. But this movie I've always like really loved, and like now that we've been talking about how great Lily is, I feel like if we made a slight tweak to the movie where like Lily's the actual genius, it would make it even better.
Yep.
So yeah, that's kind of just where I fell on this. So let's wrap this up with like scores. Does the movie pass or fail for you, and how many monocles, Eddie?
The film passes for me, despite the snubbing of Alfred Woodard's character actually embodying something that could have been greater in the Star Trek mythos. I feel like the story itself lends, you know, a great deal of credit to what the series has done thus far, creating awesome opportunities for a modern day expectation of sci-fi. We have a great cast, we have great screenwriting, and our villain is villainous. She is absolutely terrifying, and not that she's like scary looking, like compared to most other aliens we have in this franchise, she's about on par, not pon far. And so I feel like her being the villain in this one, making it the way she did and everything we got out of it, I thought the film did great. I thought the story was great, and I'm gonna give it a 4 out of 5.
Cool. Amy.
This movie does pass for me. I really enjoyed it. Even like begrudgingly, Freak-a-leak Data does save himself. And that helps with just seeing Brent Spiner in a different way. But overall, the story really does take it has amazing composition, beautiful score, and takes characters that if you are of a younger generation and grew up with TNG, you feel kind of like you're just picking back up with your crew once again as they're traveling, which is something that creates such a great continuity for somebody who may not have been watching it for long or who hasn't watched it in a long time. So I will definitely give this one a 4.6 out of 5 monocles because nice. I really liked this.
Wow. Nice. Spencer!
For me, this movie passes. It's sad to be leaving Star Trek Month, but I had a lot of fun this month. Yeah. But for this movie, yeah, this one, like, when I think of, like, Star Trek movies, this is kind of the one that pops up in my head first. Like, this is the one I fell in love with first. always have a special place in my heart. I just really liked how they were dealing with the Borg in this movie and pretty much everything that happened on the Enterprise, like even the awkward bits for me. I felt like they all worked really well. So like it was a really enjoyable watch and it is like high on my recommended list. So I will give this one a 4.5 out of 5.
There you go. Well, that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosphers and a great series for the month of September in the celebration of Star Trek. Remember, you can check us out on our website at filmlosphers.com. There you can catch all of our great episodes, allegedly over 300 episodes, where we have everything from action, romance, comedy, sci-fi, anything that you're looking for regarding the industry, we got it. Check us out, filmlosphers.com. Also, you can check us out on any place that is streaming podcasts. That is iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any of those platforms. Find us there at The Filmlosophers, where you can subscribe to our show, give us a 5-star review, let us know how we're doing. Hey, you know, we want to hear your thoughts. Check it out. We're not the Borg, but we still want to hear your thoughts. Also, you can check us out on the socials over at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. We got a lot of great stuff posting. We got some great stuff planned for the month of October, as well as another giveaway. So stay tuned as we'll be posting on there for all of that. This was a great month of Star Trekery, and I definitely want to give a big shout out to Spencer for leading the charge. Him and his wonderful brain of Star Trek stuff. He really did pull this together, and we had a great time. So, Spencer, thank you very much for this.
You're welcome, man.
This was great. If you want to catch the previous episodes, all the month of this month in September is all about Star Trek, so check it out. But, like I said, that wraps up another awesome episode. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I am Ensign Amy.
That's right. Class dismissed.
Engage! Engage.